brilliant octarine light flared in the forge. Golda Weatherwax, stripped to the waist, his face hidden by a mask of smoked glass, squinted into the glow and brought a hammer down with surgical precision. The magic squealed and writhed in the tongs, but still he worked it, drawing it into a line of agonized fire. A floorboard creaked. Golda had spent many hours tuning them, always a wise precaution with an ambitious assistant who walked like a cat. D flat. That meant he was just to the right of the door. "Ah, Trumon," he said, without turning, and noted with some satisfaction the faint indrawing of breath behind him. "Good of you to come. Shut the door, will you?" Trumon pushed the heavy door, his face expressionless. On the high shelf above him, various bottled impossibilities wallowed in their pickle jars and watched him with interest. Like all wizards' workshops, the place looked as though a taxidermist had dropped his stock in a foundry and then had a fight with a maddened glassblower, braining a passing crocodile in the process. It hung from the ceiling and smelt strongly of camphor. There were lamps and rings that Trumon itched to rub, and mirrors that looked as though they could repay a second glance. A pair of seven-league boots stirred restlessly in a cage. A whole library of grimoires, not of course as powerful as the octavo, but still heavy with spells, creaked and rattled their chains as they sensed the wizard's covetous glance on them. The naked power of it all stirred him as nothing else could. But he deplored the scruffiness and Golda's sense of theatre. For example, he happened to know that the green liquid bubbling mysteriously through a maze of contorted pipework on one of the benches was just green dye with soap in it, because he'd bribed one of the servants. One day, he thought, it's all going to go, starting with that bloody alligator. His knuckles whitened. "Well now," said Golda cheerfully, hanging up his apron and sitting back in his chair with the lion paw arms and duck legs. "You sent me this memmy thing." Trumon shrugged. "Memo. I merely pointed out, Lord, that the other orders have all sent agents to Skund Forest to recapture the spell, while you do nothing," he said. "No doubt you will reveal your reasons in good time."
"Your faith shames me," said Golda.
"The wizard who captures the spell will bring great honour on himself and his order," said Trumon. "The others have used boots and all manner of elsewhere spells. What do you propose using, Master?"
"Did I detect a hint of sarcasm there?"
"Absolutely not, Master."
"Not even a smidgen?"
"Not even the merest smidgen, Master."
"Good. Because I don't propose to go."
Golda reached down and picked up an ancient book. He mumbled a command and it creaked open. A bookmark, suspiciously like a tongue, flicked back into the binding. He fumbled down beside his cushion and produced a little leather bag of tobacco and a pipe the size of an incinerator. With all the skill of a terminal nicotine addict, he rubbed a nut of tobacco between his hands and tamped it into the bowl. He snapped his fingers and fire flared. He sucked deep, sighed with satisfaction, looked up.
"Still here, Trumon?"
"You summoned me, Master," said Trumon levelly. At least that's what his voice said. Deep in his grey eyes was the faintest glitter that said he had a list of every slight, every patronising twinkle, every gentle reproof, every knowing glance, and for every single one Golda's living brain was going to spend a year in acid.
"Oh, yes, so I did. Humour the deficiencies of an old man," said Golda pleasantly. He held up the book he had been reading. "I don't hold with all this running about," he said. "It's all very dramatic, mucking about with magic carpets and the like, but it isn't true magic to my mind. Take seven-league boots now. If men were meant to walk 21 miles at a step, I'm sure God would have given us longer legs. Where was I?"
"I'm not sure," said Trumon coldly.
"Ah, yes. Strange that we could find nothing about the Pyramid of Tsort in the library. You would have thought there'd be something, wouldn't you?"
"The librarian will be disciplined, of course." Golda looked sideways at him.
"Nothing drastic," he said. withhold his bananas, perhaps.
They looked at each other for a moment. Golda broke off first. Looking hard at Trumon always bothered him. It had the same disconcerting effect as gazing into a mirror and seeing no one there.
Anyway, he said, strangely enough, I found assistance elsewhere. In my own modest bookshelves, in fact. The Journal of Skrelt Changebasket, the founder of our order. You, my keen young man, who would rush off so soon, do you know what happens when a wizard dies?
Any spells he has memorized say themselves, said Trumon. It is one of the first things we learn.
In fact, it is not true of the original 8 great spells. By dint of a close study, Skrelt learned that a great spell will simply take refuge in the nearest mind open and ready to receive it. Just push the big mirror over here, will you?
Golda got to his feet and shuffled across to the forge, which was now cold. The strand of magic still writhed, though, at once present and not present, like a slit cut into another universe full of hot blue light. He picked it up easily, took a longbow from a rack, said a word of power, and watched with satisfaction as the magic grasped the ends of the bow and then tightened until the wood creaked. Then he selected an arrow. Trumon had tugged a heavy full-length mirror into the middle of the floor.
When I am head of the Order, he told himself, I certainly won't shuffle around in carpet slippers.
Trumon, as mentioned earlier, felt that a lot could be done by fresh blood if only the dead wood could be removed. But just for the moment he was genuinely interested in seeing what the old fool would do next. He may have derived some satisfaction if he had known that Golda and Skrelt Changebasket were both absolutely wrong. Golda made a few passes in front of the glass, which clouded over and then cleared to show an aerial view of the Forest of Skund. He looked at it intently while holding the bow with the arrow pointing vaguely at the ceiling. He muttered a few words like, allow for wind and speed of, say, 3 knots, and adjust for temperature, and then with a rather disappointing movement, released the arrow. If the laws of action and reaction had anything to do with it, it should have flopped to the ground a few feet away, but no one was listening to them. With a sound that defies description, but which for the sake of completeness can be thought of basically as spang plus 3 days' hard work in any decently equipped radiophonic workshop, the arrow vanished. Golda threw the bow aside and grinned.
Of course, it'll take about an hour to get there, he said. Then the spell will simply follow the ionized path back here. To me.
Remarkable, said Trumon. But any passing telepath would have read in letters 10 yards high, if you, then why not me? He looked down at the cluttered workbench, where a long and very sharp knife looked tailor-made for what he suddenly had in mind. Violence was not something he liked to be involved in except at one remove, but the Pyramid of Sort had been quite clear about the rewards for whoever brought all 8 spells together at the right time. And Trumon was not about to let years of painstaking work go for nothing because some old fool had a bright idea.
"Would you like some cocoa while we're waiting?"
said Golda, hobbling across the room to the servant's bell.
"Certainly," said Trumon. He picked up the knife, weighing it for balance and accuracy. "I must congratulate you, Master. I can see that we must all get up very early in the morning to get the better of you."
Golda laughed, and the knife left Trumon's hand at such speed that, because of the somewhat sluggish nature of disc light, it actually grew a bit shorter and a little more massive as it plunged with unerring aim towards Golda's neck. It didn't reach it. Instead, it swerved to one side and began a fast orbit, so fast that Golda appeared suddenly to be wearing a metal collar. He turned around, and to Trumon it seemed that he had suddenly grown several feet taller and much more powerful. The knife broke away and shuddered into the door, a mere shadow's depth from Trumon's ear.
"Early in the morning," said Golda pleasantly. "My dear lad, you will need to stay up all night."
"Have a bit more table," said Rincewind.
"No, thanks, I don't like marzipan," said Twoflower. "Anyway, I'm sure it's not right to eat other people's furniture."
"Don't worry," said Swires. The old witch hasn't been seen for years. They say she was done up good and proper by a couple of young tearaways.
Kids of today, commented Rincewind.
I blame the parents, said Twoflower.
Once you had made the necessary mental adjustments, the gingerbread cottage was quite a pleasant place. Residual magic kept it standing, and it was shunned by such local wild animals who hadn't already died of terminal tooth decay. A bright fire of licorice logs burned rather messily in the fireplace. Rincewind had tried gathering wood outside, but had given up. It's hard to burn wood that talks to you. He belched.
This isn't very healthy, he said. I mean, why sweets? Why not crisp bread and cheese? Or salami? Now, I could do with a nice salami sofa.
Search me, said Swires. Old Granny Whitlow just did sweets. You should have seen her meringues.
I have, said Rincewind. I looked at the mattresses.
Gingerbread is more traditional, said Twoflower.
What, for mattresses?
Don't be silly, said Twoflower, reasonably. Whoever heard of a gingerbread mattress?
Rincewind grunted. He was thinking of food, more accurately, of food in Ankh-Morpork. Funny how the old place seemed more attractive the further he got away from it. He only had to close his eyes to picture in dribbling detail the food stalls of 100 different cultures in the marketplaces. You could eat squishy or shark's fin soup so fresh that swimmers wouldn't go near it. And,
do you think I could buy this place? Said Twoflower.
Rincewind hesitated. He'd found it always paid to think very carefully before answering Twoflower's more surprising questions.
What for? He said cautiously.
Well, it just reeks of ambience.
Oh.
What's ambience?
Said Swires, sniffing cautiously and wearing the kind of expression that said he hadn't done it, whatever it was.
I think it's a kind of frog, said Rincewind. Anyway, you can't buy this place because there isn't anyone to buy it from.
I think I could probably arrange that on behalf of the Forest Council, of course,
interrupted Swires, trying to avoid Rincewind's glare.
And anyway, you couldn't take it with you. I mean, you could hardly pack it in the luggage, could you?
Rincewind indicated the luggage, which was lying by the fire and managing in some quite impossible way to look like a contented but alert tiger, and then looked back at Twoflower. His face fell.
Could you? He repeated.
He had never quite come to terms with the fact that the inside of the luggage didn't seem to inhabit quite the same world as the outside. Of course, this was simply a byproduct of its essential weirdness. But it was disconcerting to see Twoflower fill it full of dirty shirts and old socks, and then open the lid again on a pile of nice crisp laundry smelling faintly of lavender. Twoflower also bought a lot of quaint native artifacts, or, as Rincewind would put it, junk. And even a 7-foot ceremonial pig-tickling pole seemed to fit inside quite easily without sticking out anywhere.
I don't know, said Twoflower. You're a wizard. You know about these things.
Yes, well, of course, but baggage magic is a highly specialised art, said Rincewind. Anyway, I'm sure the gnomes wouldn't really want to sell it. He groped through what he knew of Twoflower's mad vocabulary. It's a tourist attraction.
What's that?
Said Swires interestedly.
It means that lots of people like him will come and look at it, said Rincewind.
Why?
Because, Rincewind groped for words, it's quaint. Oldie-worldy. Folkloresque. It's a delightful example of a vanished folk art steeped in the traditions of an age long gone.
It is?
Said Swires, looking at the cottage in bewilderment.
Yes.
All that?
Afraid so.
I'll help you pack.
And the night wears on, under a blanket of lowering clouds which covers most of the disk. Which is fortuitous, because when it clears and the astrologers get a good view of the sky, they are going to get angry and upset. And in various parts of the forest, parties of wizards are getting lost and going round in circles, and hiding from each other and getting upset, because whenever they bump into a tree, it apologises to them. But unsteadily though it may be, many of them are getting quite close to the cottage. Which is a good time to get back to the rambling buildings of Unseen University, and in particular the apartments of Greyhald Spold, currently the oldest wizard on the disk, and determined to keep it that way. He has just been extremely surprised and upset. For the last few hours he has been very busy. He may be deaf and a little hard of thinking, but elderly wizards have a very well-trained survival instinct, and they know that when a tall figure in a black robe and the latest in agricultural hand tools starts looking thoughtfully at you, it is time to act fast. The servants have been dismissed. The doorways have been sealed with a paste made from powdered mayflies, and protective octagrams have been drawn on the windows. Rare and rather smelly oils have been poured in complex patterns on the floor, in designs which hurt the eyes and suggest the designer was drunk, or from some other dimension, or possibly both. In the very centre of the room is the eightfold octagram of withholding, surrounded by red and green candles, and in the centre of that is a box made from wood of the curly fern pine, which grows to a great age, and it is lined with red silk and yet more protective amulets. Because Greyhound Spold knows that death is looking for him, and has spent many years designing an impregnable hiding place. He has just set the complicated clockwork of the lock and shut the lid, lying back in the knowledge that here at last is the perfect defence against the most ultimate of all his enemies, although as yet he has not considered the important part that air holes must play in an enterprise of this kind. And right beside him, very close to his ear, a voice has just said,
"Dark in here, isn't it?"
It began to snow. The barley sugar windows of the cottage showed bright and cheerful against the blackness. At one side of the clearing, three tiny red points of light glowed momentarily, and there was the sound of a chesty cough, abruptly silenced.
"Shut up!" hissed a third rank wizard. "They'll hear us."
"Who will? We gave the lads from the Brotherhood of the Hoodwink the slip in the swamp, and those idiots from the Venerable Council of Seers went off the wrong way anyway."
"Yeah," said the most junior wizard, "but who keeps talking to us? They say this is a magic wood. It's full of goblins and wolves and trees,"
said a voice out of the darkness high above. It possessed what can only be described as timbre.
"Yeah,"
said the youngest wizard. He sucked on his dog end and shivered. The leader of the party peered over the rock and watched the cottage.
"Right then,"
he said, knocking out his pipe on the heel of his seven-league boot, who squeaked in protest.
"We rush in, we grab them, we're away, okay?"
"You sure it's just people?"
said the youngest wizard nervously.
"Of course I'm sure," snarled the leader. "What do you expect, three bears?" "They could be monsters. This is the sort of wood that has monsters."
"And trees,"
said a friendly voice from the branches.
"Yeah,"
said the leader cautiously. Rincewind looked carefully at the bed. It was quite a nice little bed in a sort of hard toffee inlaid with caramel, but he'd rather eat it than sleep in it, and it looked as though someone already had.
"Someone's been eating my bed," he said.
"I like toffee," said Twoflower defensively.
"If you don't watch out, the fairy will come and take all your teeth away," said Rincewind.
"No, that's elves,"
said Swires from the dressing table.
"Elves do that. Toenails, too. Very touchy at times, elves can be."
Twoflower sat down heavily on his bed.
"You've got it wrong," he said. "Elves are noble and beautiful and wise and fair. I'm sure I read that somewhere."
Swires and Rincewind's kneecap exchanged glances.
"I think you must be thinking about different elves,"
the gnome said slowly.
"We've just got the other sort round here. Not that you'd call them quick-tempered,"
he added hastily.
"Not if you didn't want to take your teeth home in your hat, anyway."
There was the tiny distinctive sound of a nougat door opening. At the same time, from the other side of the cottage came the faintest of tinkles, like a rock smashing a barley sugar window as delicately as possible.
"What was that?" said Twoflower.
"Which one?" said Rincewind.
There was the clonk of a heavy branch banging against the windowsill. With a cry of,
"Elves!"
Swires scuttled across the floor to a mouse hole and vanished.
"What shall we do?" said Twoflower.
"Panic," said Rincewind, hopefully.
He always held that panic was the best means of survival. Back in the olden days, his theory went, people faced with hungry saber-toothed tigers could be divided very simply into those who panicked and those who stood there saying, "What a magnificent brute!" and, "Here, pussy!" "There's a cupboard," said Twoflower, pointing to a narrow door that was squeezed between the wall and the chimney breast. they scrambled into sweet, musty darkness. There was the creak of a chocolate floorboard outside. Someone said,
"I heard voices."
Someone else said,
"Yeah, downstairs. I think it's the hoodwinkers."
"I thought you said we'd given them the slip."
"Hey, you two, you can eat this place. Here, look, you can..." "Shut up."
There was a lot more creaking and a muffled scream from downstairs where a venerable seer, creeping carefully through the darkness from the broken window, had trodden on the fingers of a hoodwinker who was hiding under the table. There was the sudden zip and zing of magic.
"Bugger,"
said a voice outside. "They've got him. Let's go." There was more creaking and then silence. After a while, Two Flower said,
"Rincewind, I think there's a broomstick in this cupboard."
"Well, what's so unusual about that?"
"This one's got handlebars."
There was a piercing shriek from below. In the darkness, a wizard had tried to open the luggage's lid. A crash from the scullery indicated the sudden arrival of a party of illuminated mages of the Unbroken Circle.
"What do you think they're after?"
whispered Two Flower.
"I don't know, but I think it might be a good idea not to find out," said Rincewind thoughtfully.
"You could be right."
Rincewind pushed open the door gingerly. The room was empty. He tiptoed across to the window and looked down into the upturned faces of three brothers of the Order of Midnight.
"That's him!"
He drew back hurriedly and rushed for the stairs. The scene below was indescribable, but since that statement would earn the death penalty in the reign of Olaf Quimby II, the attempt better be made. Firstly, most of the struggling wizards were trying to illuminate the scene by various flames, fireballs, and magical glows, so the overall lighting gave the impression of a disco in a strobe light factory. Each man was trying to find a position from which he could see the rest of the room without being attacked himself, and absolutely everyone was trying to keep out of the way of the luggage, which had two venerable seers pinned in a corner and was snapping its lid at anyone who approached. But one wizard did happen to look up.
"It's him!"
Rincewind jerked back, and something bumped into him. He looked around hurriedly and stared where he saw Two Flower sitting on the broomstick, which was floating in midair.
"The witch must have left it behind," said Two Flower. "A genuine magic broomstick."
Rincewind hesitated. Octarine sparks were spitting off the broomstick's bristles, and he hated heights almost more than anything else. But what he really hated more than anything at all was a dozen very angry and bad-tempered wizards rushing up the stairs towards him, and this was happening.
"All right," he said, "but I'll drive."
He lashed out with a boot at a wizard who was halfway through a spell of binding and jumped onto the broomstick, which bobbed down the stairwell and then turned upside down so that Rincewind was horribly eye to eye with the Brother of Midnight. He yelped and gave the handlebars a convulsive twist. Several things happened at once. The broomstick shot forward and broke through the wall in a shower of crumbs. The luggage surged forwards and bit the brother in the leg. And with a strange whistling sound, an arrow appeared from nowhere, missed Rincewind by inches, and struck the luggage's lid with a very solid thud. The luggage vanished. In a little village deep in the forest, an ancient shaman threw a few more twigs on his fire and stared through the smoke at his shame-faced apprentice.
"A box with legs on?" he said.
"Yes, master. It just appeared out of the sky and looked at me," said the apprentice.
"It had eyes, then, this box?"
"No,"
began the apprentice, and stopped, puzzled. The old man frowned.
"Many have seen Topaxi, god of the red mushroom, and they earn the name of Shaman," he said. "Some have seen Skelde, spirit of the smoke, and they are called sorcerers. A few have been privileged to see Cheryl, the soul of the forest, and they are known as spirit masters. But none have seen a box with hundreds of legs that looked at them without eyes, and they are known as idiot."
The interruption was caused by a sudden screaming noise and a flurry of snow and sparks that blew the fire across the dark hut. There was a brief, blurred vision, and then the opposite wall was blasted aside, and the apparition vanished. There was a long silence, then a slightly shorter silence. Then the old shaman said carefully,
"You didn't just see two men go through upside down on a broomstick, shouting and screaming at each other, did you?"
The boy looked at him levelly.
"Certainly not," he said.
The old man heaved a sigh of relief.
"Thank goodness for that," he said. "Neither did I."
The cottage was in turmoil because not only did the wizards want to follow the broomstick, they also wanted to prevent each other from doing so, and this led to several regrettable incidents. The most spectacular, and certainly the most tragic, happened when one seer attempted to use his seven-league boots without the proper sequence of spells and preparations. Seven-league boots, as has already been intimated, are a tricksy form of magic at best, and he remembered too late that the utmost caution must be taken in using a means of transport which, when all is said and done, relies for its effectiveness on trying to put one foot 21 miles in front of the other. The first snowstorms of winter were raging, and in fact there was a suspiciously heavy covering of cloud over most of the disk. And yet from far above and by the silver light of the Discworld's tiny moon, it presented one of the most beautiful sights in the multiverse. Great streamers of cloud, hundreds of miles long, swirled from the waterfall at the rim of the mountains of the hub. In the cold, crystal silence, the huge white spiral glittered frostily under the stars, imperceptibly turning, very much as though God had stirred his coffee and then poured the cream in. Nothing disturbed the glowing scene, which... Something small and distant broke through the cloud layer, trailing sheds of vapour. In the stratospheric calm, the sounds of bickering became sharp and clear.
"You said you could fly one of these things."
"No, I didn't. I just said you couldn't."
"But I've never been on one before."
"What a coincidence."
"Anyway, you said, look at the sky."
"No, I didn't."
"What's happened to the stars?"
And so it was that Rincewind and Twoflower became the first two people on the disc to see what the future held. 1,000 miles behind them, the hub mountain of Cori Celesti stabbed the sky and cast a knife-bright shadow across the broiling clouds, so that gods ought to have noticed too. But the gods don't normally look at the sky, and in any case were engaged in litigation with the ice giants, who had refused to turn their radio down. Rimwards, in the direction of Great Artuin's travel, the sky had been swept of stars. In that circle of blackness there was just one star, a red and baleful star, a star like the glitter in the eye socket of a rabid mink. It was small and horrible and uncompromising, and the disk was being carried straight towards it. Rincewind knew precisely what to do in these circumstances. He screamed and pointed the broomstick straight down.